Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Lot to share. Today, we're going to take a look at what's in that can of soda that could be causing such a bad situation in your body. Some new research out of Lund University in Sweden deals with that. Also, lycopene. It's in watermelon. It's in red raspberries and cherries, but it's also in tomatoes. It does something really good for you. We'll talk about that. And loneliness, like chronic stress, taxes the immune system. New research on why we have to deal with our loneliness issues in the United States. And a lot of people are lonely. And which nutritional factors help preserve muscle mass and strength as you age? We have a lot to share on health and nutrition topics, always from peer-reviewed literature. Then a commentary from Glenn Greenwald, The Untouchables, how the Obama administration protected Wall Street from prosecutions. A new PBS Frontline report examines a profound failure of justice that should be causing serious social unrest. Then my guest in the second part of our program will be Jerry Mander from San Francisco. The Wall Street Journal called Jerry Mander the Ralph Nader of advertising. He is a national social critic and activist, a community organizer, and the founder and director emeritus of the International Forum on Globalization. And he's written many books, including The Capitalism Papers, Fatal Flaws of an Obsolete System. We're going to talk about capitalism today. Can it be reformed? And if it can, how? And if not, what should take its place? Then from our environmental side of the program today, we're going to look at the melting glaciers in the Andes and how that's happening now at such an accelerated rate that a lot of people in South America that depend upon the melting glaciers will not have that water in the next 5 to 10 years. Also, it was a bad year for people who had to pay a lot more for food. It was a very good year for Goldman Sachs that made $400 million betting on food prices. And a billion people went hungry. So we're going to deal with that. Also, from our environmental segment, the outgoing head, or one of the top scientists of the Obama administration, comes clean, tells us about what the likelihood of the future is now that we've had Hurricane Sandy. And, quote, she says, all the cities on the East Coast are sitting ducks. What does that mean? Also, vast amounts of wastewater as fracking expands. And this is something that's rarely discussed. And an interesting satellite shot from space, you think there's a major city in Montana and Wyoming. It's not. It's thousands of gas hydrofracking wells all over Montana and Wyoming. Also today from our environmental segment, we want to talk about I'll deal with some other issues. I don't know if I'm going to have time to deal with all this. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. According to alternate Scott Thrill, say it ain't so, a can of soda a day can increase the risk of cancer for men by 40%. That's according to a study from Lund University, published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Now, here's what makes it bad. They're talking about one single daily can of soda will increase a man's risk of prostate cancer by 40% compared to a man that doesn't drink it. And yet we have no major outcry about this in the United States. There are also carcinogens involved and additives like caffeine, sugar, and worse. And most of those we have no attention to, meaning they're not in the ads. We just see the ads. Quote, when it comes to studies of soda consumption, chronic disease risk, the only superior alternative to a prospective cohort study would be to conduct a randomized controlled trial where you assign one group to drink high amounts of soda for 20 years and the other group not to consume soda. But of course, this is unethical and would never be feasible. why don't we know what's wrong with sodas? Could it be that they're making $60 billion a year? In fact, soda competes for drug market shares, and it's big. So for $60 billion in profit, it's highly unlikely anyone in the field is ever going to be honest and tell us what the real outcome of consuming their products would be. Now, there's a lot of good evidence. It was published in the British Journal of Nutrition that shows that those who take lycopene, that would be like from tomatoes or watermelon, substantially reduce your risk of heart disease. In fact, the highest average intakes of lycopene were linked to 26% reduction in the incidence of cardiovascular disease and coronary heart disease. And that's really good. Remember, anything that's pink, like pink grapefruits or red sweet peppers, all right, red raspberries, red plums, red cherries, red watermelon, and red tomatoes, all of those are good in lycopene. Quote, the present study of lycopene and the incidence of coronary vascular disease adds to the accumulating evidence that lycopene is related to coronary vascular disease, end quote. And that was the lead researcher from the Jean Mayer U.S. Department of Agricultural Health Nutrition Center on Aging at Tufts University. Loneliness. We have a lot of people in the United States who are lonely, and most of the time what they do is they go on and surf the internet and become friends with people who like something about them. It's also abstract and it's also superficial. And historically, people just watch television. You became friends with the people on television. I was curious when I was in my teen years, especially coming from a small community where in the afternoon, most people at home, and the majority of them were women, watched soap operas. And when you would have a conversation with them, they would talk as if these plots and dramas were real. Well, such and such said this, and then this happened. And I remember thinking at the time, it's just make-believe. And I couldn't understand why they became so emotionally invested in the outcome of a soap opera. And of course, these soap operas lasted some clear up until now. But now none of the soap operas can compete with a reality show. And people would rather see the dysfunction and the degradation in the nature of human behavior and relationships in a reality show, because you know that someone's going to get screamed at, cursed, and spat upon or fought, always at a certain point with someone pulling them apart, Jerry Springer style. And why would you even want to see that? What is the fascination with us watching deprivation? It's like saying, let's go watch the skies and hope that a plane falls out of the sky. Why? Why would you want to see that? Someone who has an authentically balanced life would not want to see that. I guess it tells us a lot about who we really are, not who's providing us with the medium of such degradation. In any case, a lot of people are just lonely. And if you're lonely, and maybe you're lonely for reasons that really are not within your control, or maybe you have said you're too old now. I remember there was an article in the New York Times about a man in his 40s going to disco, and how odd that was, because the people in disco are late teens and early 20s. Why would you, who was old enough to be their father, why would you go? As if suddenly someone shouldn't go and dance and have a good time at a disco. And that's how that's ageist philosophy, you know, act your age. Why should we? Well, a lot of people may feel a different age than what they are chronologically. So for all the different reasons of social isolation and incompatibility with the people around us or our environment, or people working very long hours and a lot of days, not having time to go out and enjoy, you know, relationships, they watch television or spend time on the internet. But there's a price to pay for loneliness. This is the latest from Ohio State University. Here's what it says. New research links loneliness to a number of dysfunctional immune responses, suggesting that being lonely has the potential to harm overall health. Researchers found that people who were more lonely showed signs of elevated latent herpes virus reactivation and produced more inflammation-related proteins in response to acute stress than did people who felt more socially connected. These proteins signal the presence of inflammation, and chronic inflammation is linked to numerous conditions, including coronary heart disease, type 2 diabetes, arthritis, Alzheimer's disease, as well as the frailty and functional decline that can accompany aging. Reactivation of latent herpes virus is known to be associated with stress, suggesting that loneliness functions as a chronic stressor that triggers a poorly controlled immune response. Quote, "It is clear from previous research that poor quality relationships are linked to a number of health problems, including premature death and all sorts of other very serious health conditions. And people who are lonely clearly feel like they are in poor quality relationships," end quote. Well, we're doing absolutely positively nothing to address this on a national level. In my travels, I'm just really concerned about how many people of all ages are lonely. In fact, I filmed a young man, nice-looking guy, I'm going to guess about 26, 27, and he was at a stand-down. And I was there from early in the morning before sunup. It was about 5 o'clock. And when I had the camera placed down a street, and I was rolling it as the sun rose so you could actually see the shapes. It was totally silent. And then the camera caught the images of over 1,000 men and women standing quietly in line to get led into this field. And inside the field were a group of tents and tables manned by volunteer former service personnel from, I found guys from the Korean War, lots from the Vietnam War and the Afghan conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they were there to volunteer to give people something. And the people that were getting something were former vets. So some would get a shave or haircut. A lot of them were getting haircuts. And then he got a shower, and they had a bunch of porta showers lined up. And then there was a chiropractor who would look, and there was a dentist who would look in the mouth, and a medical doctor. There was a lawyer to help them if they needed that, and they could get boots and a sleeping bag and a packet of food. And I thought it was just extremely noble that these people were doing this. Now, mind you, this was not the government, the Veterans Administration, the Defense Department. This was not Sean Hannity or the other people who are for our brave vets. No, these were other soldiers who knew the plight of these people. So I was going around filming them all day. And all of that footage in the near future I'll be putting up on my Gary Noll TV. By the way, if you haven't gone to Gary Noll TV, the other day, I don't read personal emails when I'm on the road, so please don't write me any personal emails because I won't have a chance to see it till I get out of filming, which will be another month or so, and get back to New York. In any case, I was looking and I saw some really interesting things. I was seeing first the number of homeless vets there are. It's increasing. It's now about 1 million. Secondly, I was seeing how many vets are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder or Gulf War syndrome. It's over 1 million. So you got a lot of people who are in trouble with mental or physical health, completely abandoned by the government that does absolutely nothing for them. And even when they try to do something, they could be a year late even processing. And in fact, some people, the families I filmed, were so angry because their son or daughter waited a full year in desperate need of help to get something, and the government wouldn't help them, and they died. And there are a bunch of those people. In any case, there was this one fella, and I was speaking with him, and I said, "How's it going for you?" He says, "Well, I can't find work because the moment they know that you're an ex-soldier, they don't want you." I said, "Why not?" He said, "Well, because a lot of ex-soldiers suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder from what we experienced or what we were exposed to, or whether we did anything ourselves or just witnessed it." He said, "You have to understand, when you're over there in Afghanistan or Iraq, and don't let anyone think that we're not in Iraq anymore, we are. It's just that we're there under different names, like private contractors. And there's many private contractors in Iraq as there were regular soldiers. And he said, every step you take, it could be your last steps. You have to be on 24/7 alert because you don't know who's going to shoot you. You don't know if you're going to be spotted and have a landmine go off. He said it really drives you into a high state of stress. And then you start taking these psychiatric meds. And he said he's seen so many people freak out on these meds, just went ballistic, and it's all covered up. And sexual abuse is rampant, epidemic against women and some men. And it gets covered up because they don't want to show the real nature of what it is to be in war. And these embedded journalists, he said they're really a disgrace because they never show the truth. If they did, we would have a different impression about our participation in these conflicts. So here he is, and he said he tried to get work doing anything. He said, look, occasionally I get work cutting grass, or I get work, bagging groceries in a supermarket. But it's hard to keep that job. So he said, I ended up having to steal food. And I said, what kind of food? He said, I would go down some streets and look in people's yards. If they had a fruit tree, I'd go in and take some fruit, and I'd do it at night. And at least I would have something to eat. He said, you don't understand. When you're homeless and you're a homeless vet, you really are at the bottom of the social rung. And he was hanging out with a lot of other social rejects in the woods. So that's where I went. I went and I spent time talking with them, hundreds and hundreds. And they're all lonely. The only comfort they have is with each other. And there is camaraderie amongst them. For example, in one camp, there were 9 guys and 1 woman. And they all made it very clear that that woman was protected, meaning no one's going to come and screw with her here because they'll protect the woman. And mind you, these are vets. They're all capable of handling themselves. And the woman said, you know, that this is the only place she could be protected because on the street she was beaten and she was raped. And she said, here the other vets don't do that. Well, you're wondering how in the world do you function emotionally, waking up in the morning and you have no future. And what you have in the present, you don't have water, toilets, you don't have a refrigerator. You might have some canned food. And you can walk for 4 miles and get a meal at one place if they have enough food. And sometimes they don't, or get a shower. But most time they get down to the beach if they live near the beach and take a shower in one of those showers you take to wash off from the sand. But you have to go early because the moment anyone sees you using any lather or shampoo or anything, they know that you're not just washing sand off and suddenly they don't want you. So that's loneliness also. And knowing that society has abandoned you. You no longer have a place at the table anywhere. And I don't see that being addressed at the national level at all. And it should be. Finally, which nutritional factors help preserve muscle mass, strength, and performance in seniors? By the way, by summertime, I will have my Veterans Village built, and there will be a home for vets, and they will get the psychological, holistic, psychological and physical health to help them overcome physical conditions like Gulf War syndrome and post-traumatic stress disorder, and it will be free to them. It's on my time and my dime to help them. I'm against the wars that they fought in. I am for them as human beings. Now, here's what you should do if you want to keep your muscle mass and actually expand it and burn fat. And I think both men and women of all ages should realize that the older you get, the less muscles you're going to have, and the more fat you're going to have, and the more droopy your body's going to come. Your skin's going to look like a dried rattlesnake belt. So you better do something now, and you can. Okay. And especially people suffer from sarcopenia, which is a gradual loss of muscle mass, which is common at about the age of 40, and it just accelerates after there. And that can really create disability later in life. Because after all, when you don't have muscle mass, you have a greater tendency to fall and increased risk of fractures, etc. Get at least 20 grams of protein 3 times a day. My suggestion is from a quality non-genetically engineered source, rice, soy, hemp, all good. Then make sure you're getting your vitamin D3. That helps, that preserves muscle mass and function. Then keep yourself non-acidic. I cannot explain enough how processed grains and meats and alcohol are highly acidic. You need low acid foods and high alkaline foods, the vegetables, the fruits, the lemons, those are good for you. And they create an alkaline balance, which is important for your muscle mass. Vitamin B12 and folic acid are improving muscle function and strength. Now, we know that vitamin B12 is good for mental function, and folic acid helps lower homocysteine levels and protects our heart. Most people are not aware that it's also good for hormone balance, and it does. Then conjugated linoleic acid, CLA, 3 to 5,000 milligrams a day will burn fat, and when you're doing vigorous muscle workouts, will lay down new muscle and get you really ripped, looking nice, and help you lower your percentage of body fat substantially. Then creatine monohydrate, about 3 to 5,000 milligrams a day. That'll work for you also. And also, to sustain your energy, D-ribose, 1,000 milligrams. Now, for those of you who are interested in a superfood, one good superfood is a fruit. It's called camu, C-A-M-U. And it's a fruit from the Amazon. It's native to Peru. It's used down there in everything from their ice cream to juices. In fact, you can go up to a juice bar, and I have, and get yourself. I was really dumb one day, and I saw all these exotic fruits hanging, fruits I'd never seen before in my life. Of course, you're going to have mangoes and watermelons. They have small watermelons down there, about the size of half the size of a bowling ball, and lychee and kiwi, but I didn't see any of those. I saw exotics. And so I said, these are all fruit, yes. And I saw the guy had a water filter and he had a juicer and a blender. And so I said, give me one. I said, and I had my own cup with me. I take this stainless steel cup and I said, just fill it up. So it's not that big and it's a cup. And he did. And I really enjoyed the juice. And I said, well, give me that one, and then that one, and that one. I went clear around, and I got 12. My stomach was doing a humba-jumba, but I really enjoyed the taste of it. And everything tasted different. And so if you want something really exotic, the camu juice is exotic. It's very rich in vitamin C. In fact, it contains about nearly 3,000 milligrams of vitamin C per 100 grams of pulp. Now, 100 grams is 3 ounces, so that makes it about 50 times richer in vitamin C than an orange. It contains 10 times the iron, twice the riboflavin, and about 50% of the phosphorus. So it's really good for you, and it's anti-inflammatory, it's immune-building, it helps your vision, it's antiviral, and it's not only due to vitamin C, but also the other antioxidants. So today our superfood is camu. It's good for cognition. It boosts immunity. It's strongly anti-inflammatory. It helps protect against macular degeneration. It kills a lot of viruses. It's antiseptic. It's anti-mutagenic. It protects against cancer also. So that's something we should be having here. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. you from all over the world who are tuning in, and from all the land-based stations, and those who download the show. The statistics on the show are interesting. Nearly 97% of all the people listening do not listen live at noon, Monday through Friday, or Sunday evenings at 8, or Monday evenings at 7 p.m. to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Rather, they listen overnight, over the Internet, and from our archives. So we thank you. And I also just got the latest statistics. I want to thank the nearly 42,000 new young listeners in the last week. That's 1 week. Put it in perspective, that's more than listen to all of the station's programs on WPFW in our sister station in Washington each day. And that's a lot of new listeners. That's 2 million brand new listeners, young listeners, in the next 12 months if this trend continues and expands. We welcome you. And please share the information. Share it with other people. Send it out. Let them know what you're listening to, what articles, what calls to action. Join and participate in social movements. We have a newsmaker on the phone right now. She is a part of a movement. It is a movement to make Americans aware of smart meters, why we should not have them installed, what they do, and the lies around them. The difference is this, quote, two mothers arrested in Naperville, Illinois, armed police assist force smart meter development on private homes. Two mothers arrested, why? Well, they were arrested today in conjunction with the forced installation of smart meters. A board member, Jen Stahl, was arrested today along with her friend during a forced installation at Jen's home. Jen is on the phone now. Nice to have you with us today, Jen.
And thank you for having me.
First, tell us about the arrest of you and your friend and the fact that we have now de-evolved in the United States to where homemakers are arrested by police that have been militarized for doing what exactly? What was your crime against your community and society that armed police officers were there to arrest you?
Yesterday, the city of Naperville, we have a municipal-owned utility here. The city of Naperville came for the third time to install a smart meter on my home, and I told them that I did not permit it and that I had informed the city that I refused the installation and that I was intending to keep my analog meter, and that was what I had agreed to with my contract with the city to pay them for electric usage and for them to supply it to me. And they said, well, then we're going to call the police, and they arrived, and they attempted to persuade me to allow them to do, quote-unquote, do their job, and for the city installers to do that. And I said, I will not permit them to do that. I am refusing that. And they proceeded to cut the lock on my gate for my fence and move into the backyard. And I stood in front of my electric meter and said, I am refusing for you to install this meter on my home. And the police officer said, you need to step away from the meter. And I said, I'm not permitting an installation on my home. And he said, you're under arrest. And I said, what for? And he said, for interfering. And I said, interfering with what? And he said, interfering with an officer. So I didn't, I complied because I wasn't going to resist arrest. And he proceeded to handcuff me, and the city of Naperville installers proceeded to move in and install the meter after he arrested me. And so then they took me out front and transported me. I was taken to the city jail and processed, booked, fingerprinted, photographed, et cetera. And they charged me with interfering with an officer on one ticket, and then the other citation was for breaking an ordinance that the city has that allows the city to access the meters to change them, and they said that I was blocking the meter, and that it is their right to change the meter. So that was my charges. Kim, who is my fellow board member for Naperville Smart Meter Awareness, our nonprofit organization here in Naperville, she was also here and was filming what was occurring, and the officer looked at her and said, "You're not supposed to do that." And she says, "I have a right to videotape." And he said, he told his officers to arrest her. And I was not a direct witness to the occurrence of what happened after that, because it was at that point that they were moving toward my fence. So I went to go defend my property, and they have given her two citations as well. So for attempted videotaping, and they said that they have charged her with resisting arrest.
All right. Now, what is it about the smart meters that you are willing to get yourself arrested in order to protect what? Explain to the audience who may not appreciate what smart meters are, why they are installing them, and what you're doing standing up. You stood up for something.
Yes,
why?
I did.
Why did you stand up?
The issue is complicated, and I'll try and keep it as brief as possible, because I could literally talk for a couple of hours nonstop about the issues. There are five primary areas of risk associated with smart meters. A digital wireless smart meter is a risk to health, security, privacy, costs, and safety. Safety as in like property damage. The safety issue, there's been fires. These meters have caught on fire. They have caused fires in homes with poor old wiring. The radio frequencies can cause extra vibrations on the wiring and cause fires. It is difficult to find and be able to prove evidence associated with that. And so it's, but some meters have in fact blatantly caught on fire. There's videos and newspaper reports of that. And it has happened here in Chicagoland in the ComEd, Commonwealth Edison area, where they've actually admitted and shown they have evidence of three meters catching on fire and causing damage to people's homes. The health issue is the one that got me most interested and surprising, was very skeptical at first and researched into why people would be claiming that they would be getting ill from the meters. But it's very, very clear evidence that some people are sensitive. It's literally an allergy to the radiation exposure from the wireless meters. It's kind of like a miniature cell tower antenna on the side of your house using to transmit your electric usage to the utility. And some people are sensitive to that, the radiation from it, and also the dirty electricity, which is another aspect of it that people are hard to understand from the switching power supply that's inside of it. It's a microprocessor. It's a tiny little computer inside there to record your electric consumption on a minute-by-minute basis, constantly recording your electric consumption. So that is a health risk that I was not really willing to accept, and I investigated, and I realized, I said, you know, even if some of these people are flat-out lying, which I don't believe that they are, clearly this is something that's wrong, and there's just something wrong with these things, and it just doesn't make sense. It's not the right solution to this quote-unquote problem, which there really isn't a problem that they're trying to solve by putting these in. Financially, we have searched to try to find true supportive evidence that these meters will actually conserve energy. It's not possible that they will. Only people can conserve energy. The excuse that the utilities are using is to try to sell it to people that this will give you more information about how you use your energy so that you can make decisions so that you can better conserve energy, which will thereby save you money. It's only true that people can use good, valuable data, and actually the data that they provide out of the meters is actually not very worthwhile. And there are much better devices that already exist in the marketplace that would have been better spent should this, you know, if people were to agree that this should be a valuable thing to do, that people could get that can give you more important metadata that, and it's something that the utility doesn't need to have. The utility doesn't need to know what your electric consumption information is. It's actually very private information that can be, which takes me into the privacy issue. The privacy aspect of this is because it is constantly recording your electric usage, just like an old analog meter does. It just does it on this little disc recording thing, and it's constantly recording your electric consumption, but the digital meter can records it on a level and puts it to this computer processing and saves the information, and then that data can be pulled off, processed through another software system that can then identify exactly what's going on inside the house, depending on the level, the incremental level that they record. Our city is recording it in 15-minute increments, but most smart meters are capable of recording in 1-minute or 5-minute increments. And the more, the smaller the incremental increment of saving the recording is, the more minute that it is, the more detail they can derive to show what is going on inside the home. And at the very, very least, they, with ours, 15-minute increments, they can tell whether you are home or when you're not at home. So that privacy issue right there alone is enough to instigate what was what we started. We filed a federal lawsuit against the city on the basis of that our constitutional rights are being violated for the 4th, 5th, and 14th Amendments, and that, you know, our property rights are at risk here. So I've covered health, covered privacy, cost. Security is another big one. They've essentially placed a wireless network on our entire electrical grid, and wireless networks are very, very susceptible, are the easiest methods for hackers to access. And it puts a risk not just at my personal data, but at the risk of the entire electrical grid. The whole city could relatively easily be hacked into through the wireless network, and firewalls can be broken down through, you know, various terrorism acts or just shenanigans, but even by a teenager. And there's clear articles out there, very recent articles, showing that the security system is entirely hackable. So our electric grid is at risk. It could be shut down by terrorists or other, you know, other areas, people that want to try and prove whatever they're after. So the security risk alone is a huge impact. So, and I guess that's as best I could say in a nutshell, and there's evidence upon evidence upon evidence to show that all of these areas are a significant risk to everyone that is facing the attempt by their utility to put this on there and say, well, this is what we've decided, and we've decided it's best for you, and we're going to do that for you. This whole process came around about roughly around 2005, the federal government enacted the Energy Policy Act of 2005, and within it, they recommended that that all utilities offer smart meters and what they call time of use pricing to customers. They wanted to make it available because the federal government, based on my understanding, can't really force it on anybody. Because of course we have it's a United States of America, and the states' rights should supersede our federal government. So it was a recommendation from the federal government, but a lot has happened since then, and utilities are being snowed into believing that this is actually something that's very good for them, and that it actually will conserve energy for the utilities and thereby save them money. It will be a good savings being sold to the public, as you're going to have an opportunity to save money. And our city took advantage of federal stimulus funds from the stimulus bill, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, in 2009, I think it was, and they accepted $11 million in federal grant money, matching grant. So our city put up $11 million, which they had to borrow, to expedite their plan to put in a smart grid here in Naperville. Our city has extremely, extremely reliable power. They have gone through the process of burying cable, and we have almost 90-something percent underground power lines in our city. And we have very rarely lost power in our municipality, and they're trying to explain that this will make our power grid more reliable. We figured that about $3 million of the $22 million was worthy. They were going to be upgrading some distribution systems, substation automation, those sorts of things we thought were worthwhile effort. The rest of it was all going to putting in smart meters and putting up the network in order to get that data back to the city.
Jen, we're out of time, but my perspective, the city of Naperville has crossed a line.
Absolutely.
In that no matter how we look at it, private property is private property.
Mm-hmm.
It should not be the right of a municipality, even one that only has one power a company. Naperville owns the municipal utility for electricity. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the citizens of the town don't have options unless you're choosing to go with solar or wind or something you create yourself. But I see this a little differently. I see this as one more intrusion into monitoring our lives. Do you remember with the FISA, the major internet companies were all guilty of allowing the government to spy on citizens by capturing their emails and phone calls and text messages and sending through the National Security Agency, all of which was illegal. And even Barack Obama, when he was not president, said that this was a violation, and as a constitutional lawyer and a professor, he knew it was. The moment he was in power, he voted for it, as did all these other so-called good Democrats who care about it. And then on the other side, the so-called good Republicans who are supposed to care about the Constitution and Bill of Rights voted for the government to decriminalize all the acts that had occurred. In effect, they went back and gave him a clean bill of health. But it was show that they had been spying on us. And that's wrong. So I don't believe that the government has a right to come into our homes and tell us that you must have these smart meters. And besides, there's also other information that is still to be verified that it's more than just telling us whether or not we're using our electricity in a efficient way. It's also a way of monitoring our whereabouts in the house and also the ability to use this smart meter to interface with our computers or even television. There's a whole new level of technology that is available that we'll be doing a show on in the near future about be careful about some of these high-end model televisions and high-end computers because they can monitor you, your conversations, and video stream you. And now the largest intelligence agency in the United States, the National Security Agency, is building this multi-billion dollar center out west, I think it's in Utah, where they're capturing trillions of pieces of information and have now, as it turns out, for 10 years. So virtually everyone has everything that you've ever said or written or emailed, any electronic information, in a database. Since when is this not a constitutional issue of privacy? So what they do with it is really irrelevant. You know, the fact that they've been able to collect it is what is relevant. We've already missed that. So I thank you for standing up, allowing yourself to be arrested. And it also tells us as much about the police today and that what they're willing to do. Last evening, I saw a piece of a video that I'll be putting up in about 4 days on my show. It was about farming in America and how the government at the USDA is putting in place laws that would virtually make it impossible for small and organic farmers to be sustainable, but the large major farms to dominate. And the first 20 minutes of the film was about a small little farm by two people, including a PhD, retired from NASA, and his wife, who had retired from Boston, I think Brown University. They opened up a little organic sheep milk farm, and they had all their sheep certified before coming in the country, then recertified for health when they were in the country. And then it shows how the state went after them, how the federal government went after them, confiscated their sheep, tore down their whole house, held them, and even though they had done nothing wrong, and it turns out that their sheep were completely healthy, but they shot all their sheep, killed all their sheep. And then another scene shows a bunch of police in Los Angeles coming in with firearms ready to shoot anyone. And what they were raiding was a food co-op, you know, in Los Angeles. A food co-op where people are selling bean sprouts. And the idea that now you take, I think in one raid, they took 40 fully armed SWAT team to an Amish farm. And this is becoming the new norm, so it no longer shocks us. But it should. Because then when you step over that line, and then suddenly you deputize TSA agents, and now you get them to where they can stop and search you anywhere, and you then allow them to carry guns, we are becoming a police state, and I'm concerned about it. and I'm going to continue to challenge them on the way that they're dealing with people. But yours is a cause. You're highly articulate. You have courage. You stood up. Good for you. Hopefully some of the mainstream media will get involved and look at your story. I appreciate you being on with us today. All the best to you. I'm Gary Knoll. Let's go over now to my guest who's standing by. He is Jerry Mander from San Francisco. I gave you his background earlier. He's very concerned as a national social critic and activist and community organizer and the founder and director emeritus of the International Forum on Globalization in San Francisco about capitalism and the fatal flaws and the question whether capitalism is capable of being reformed. Nice to have you with us today, Jerry.
Thank you so much, Gary. Appreciate it.
Let's begin with a general issue. And we often hear criticisms about our global economy coming from different directions. And the terms we most often hear are laissez-faire economy or neoliberal free market or fair trade or free market fundamentalism. Then there are the battles between various modalities of capitalism, Keynesian, the Chicago and Austrian schools, Hayek and others. But all of these fall under one single umbrella that we call capitalism. So while we hear these other expressions tossed about as the cause of the country's and the world's economic woes, we rarely hear that it is capitalism itself as a major culprit that needs to be reformed. And since defining capitalism's intrinsic characteristics has been a major part of your recent work, please begin, Jerry, by addressing the question about why we are afraid to challenge capitalism and evaluate its worth and value on its own terms. And as a tail to that question, today, the latest statistics were released showing that around the world, unemployment is going up and the economy and gross domestic products are going down to a dangerous level. And all of those models are based upon capitalism. Your thoughts?
And at the same time, profits are going up at a very staggeringly, at an amazing increasing rate. Unemployment goes down largely also as an expression of the way capitalists make decisions in terms of automation, replacing workers, etc. But your main question is very, very appropriate. It's you know, it's like capitalism's a word that's not used really in debates about the economy in mainstream contexts. It's not really used at all now, and it's not even used in the context of people opposing terrible excesses. I mean, I've been listening to your very interesting discussion about smart meters. You could say that all of the major debates, you know, political debates and struggles that we're involved with now, climate change, what to do about guns, gun ownership, GMOs. I saw your terrific film on GMOs, genetically modified organisms, the military expansion and military technology development and so on, and the move toward, you know, completely automated systems and in production and communications and so on, all of these have terrible downside effects, and there's lots of movements. I've been associated with them for, you know, 50 years, as you know. All of these movements argue the battle in right on the local terrain, that is to say, GMOs are bad for you. Why aren't corporations stopping? Why do they keep using GMOs? Why can't we stop expansion of guns? You know, why can't we stop climate change? And usually the reason is that we fight every battle on a level that allows the intrinsic drives of capitalism to really determine what will happen. In other words, we have a society that's completely organized along capitalist principles, which means that there are several important ingredients. One of them is corporations, which are the prime expression of capitalism, must grow. They not only must grow, they must grow at a rate equal to 8 or 10%, or they're essentially falling behind the curve of investment. That is to say, they need constantly new investment in order to continue to profit successfully. So in order to get that investment, they have to grow at a very rapid rate. And if they don't keep growing, then the entire system starts deflating. That's why every politician and most mainstream news commentators and most mainstream media and most mainstream organizations are constantly arguing about grow. We must grow. And growth, of course, was possible at an age where we had lots of abundant resources and lots of cheap labor and slave labor in order to feed the growth, but it's no longer possible on the planet now. We're way overused, and we have climate change and all these problems, but still we pursue growth because that's the only way that corporations can flourish, and because that's they have to grow. It's built into the DNA of a large corporation that it must grow. And the questions of why corporations behave that way, why don't we have a more conscious capitalism? I heard the head of Whole Foods use that term the other day. And it's as if corporations, have the option, that's to say large corporations have the option to make pro-social and pro-environment choices, and we wonder why they don't do that. And it's because capitalism has only one driving purpose, and that is to constantly expand wealth, to constantly expand growth. And that's an amoral principle. In other words, it has nothing to do with whether it's good growth or bad growth. If it's making guns, that's how you grow, then let's make more guns and let's sell more guns. If it's about oil, let's sell more oil, let's use more oil, never mind about climate change. I don't know if you saw the movie Avatar. That was a very interesting movie, I thought. And it's about a corporation that's searching for, because it revealed this problem. It's a corporation traveling the cosmos looking for more resources and finds them on this little planet far away from Earth, and so it wants to develop these resources, and so the spaceship commander sends a military crew down to the Indians who live on this planet, telling them they have to leave because they need to develop the planet. They have to dig out the resources there, and the Indians will just have to go somewhere else. And the Indians, of course, say no, and so then the head of the corporation has to decide what to do about that. And he has this little dialogue that I thought was fantastic in that movie. He says, it was the greatest moment in the movie. He says out loud, "Well, the question is really, should we kill these Indians or not to get them off the land? And our shareholders, we have millions of shareholders, they're not going to like the idea if we kill these Indians. On the other hand, they care more about whether we have profits at the end of the year than whether we kill the Indians. So, yeah, go ahead and kill the Indians." And then he releases his military to do that. And that's the kind of decision that a GMO corporation makes, if it's not about killing Indians, but or any of these resource-based corporations, or even these smart meters that you've been talking about, these companies that manufacture that stuff, they're dedicated to their profit line. That's what they do. Moral questions don't come into the picture. We, as activists, try to raise moral questions to deal with them about it, but the system itself prevents us from doing very much about it, because the system is built on expansion, and the politicians are paid by the system. That's another element we have to talk about when we have more time. So the government is essentially privatized now more than ever, and public consciousness is within the framework of corporate success. Jobs are located in only corporations. The entire system is operating on a set of drives that prevent it from doing the right thing. And in the book, I use the term corporate schizophrenia. In other words, it's not even about personal greed. The head of a corporation may be a perfectly good guy. He's your neighbor. His kids go to the same school you do. He's a religious person, etc. But he makes decisions that destroy nature, destroy people, destroy community, because that's what the corporation requires. Once he's inside the corporation, he's no longer a person. He's fulfilling the drives of a machine that has to grow and has to make profit. And that is all part of the central driving principles of capitalism. So we have to not be afraid anymore to try to speak of the inherent drives of the system, rather than speaking only of the specific battles that we're undertaking. We have to do those too, but we have to really get at the structural elements of the system that require that good people do bad things inside corporations, and realize that that whole mode of production is now out of date. It's obsolete. It won't work on a planet with scarce resources, with all these feedbacks from nature like climate change and fresh water depletion, destruction of the soil, and so on. It's going on rampantly in the world. And we have to start talking about systemic change. And so that's really the focus of the book, and it describes a whole long series of intrinsic elements of the sort that I just described: amorality, intrinsic growth, privatization of government, that kind of thing.
Well, you're listening.
That's a longer answer than you wanted, probably,
no,
Gary.
But that's a good answer. Jerry Mander, my guest. The book is The Capitalism Papers, Fatal Flaws of an Obsolete System. And for those of you listening on our land-based stations, we're going to say goodbye. For those who are listening over the telephone, and I'll give you that number, or listening over Progressive Radio Network, we're going to continue with Jerry because I still have some more questions. And that number is 832-280-0066. 832-280-0066. Anywhere in North America, including Canada, you dial that number and you can hear this show anywhere. Truckers, train drivers, you name it, cab drivers, they're all listening. And people who want to be away from the internet, away from their home, but listen, 832-280-0066. Now, Jerry, for the second part of the issue, first and foremost, I'd like you to hit on some your opinion of some thoughts I have.
Sure.
One is that would shareholders think differently about the nature of profits if they actually had to see how the profits were made and what consequences that they impacted upon other people, such as in apartheid in South Africa, many American corporations were making good profits, but at what cost? They weren't there to see the suffering of the people in apartheid
right.
regimes. The same with munitions makers making landmines,
right.
or Boeing and some of its and some of the other military industrial contractors. We never look at the end a product. We only look at the profits we get from the sale of that service. So
right.
I'm interested in, would that make a difference? Possibly, possibly not. I'm interested in your opinion separately.
I think reaching to individual shareholders might make a difference. But let me make two distinctions. The first one is, when we're speaking about capitalism, the capitalism that we have to worry about is shareholder-oriented, large-scale, national and global capitalism. The people who run the market, you know, in your town, or who, you know, run a fabric store or a coffee house or small-scale local enterprise, family-run enterprise, that should not even be called capitalism because it doesn't operate on the absolute need to grow, expand that larger-scale capitalism does depend upon. And that's the shareholder owned capitalism of stock market and financial investments and banks and so on. That's the main problem of our time. Local economy and businesses, private businesses, are not causing the world problems. And they can behave badly or they can behave well, but they don't have the intrinsic drive to expand, grow, and ignore community values and community standards. Now, the larger scale system, the one that you asked me about shareholders, I do think there's a level where shareholders do get upset, and then corporations will sometimes respond and decide that, on balance, they're probably going to do better. They're going to make more profit, actually, if they don't get all their shareholders angry. If you get shareholders selling their stock because they're angry about something, let's say about GMO production, or any of these other things that you described, military production, the owners of the corporation, the managers of the corporation, who are usually, by the way, the main shareholders, that is to say, there are usually in big corporations very few banks and gigantic oligarchic, billionaires who tend to dominate even the shareholder community. They don't really care about the they already know what the consequences are. But if there is an organized movement among shareholders to say, we didn't realize that this company we hold, you know, we hold 100 shares in some company, and we didn't know that their mining operations in Africa are, you know, killing the local native population or polluting the rivers or whatever. Now that we know that, we want to tell the owners of the corporation, the larger shareholders of the corporation, we don't like it. We don't want you to do that anymore. And there have been a lot of successful shareholder uprisings. But first, getting the news to the shareholders and getting shareholders who often don't even know what shares they're holding. You know, most shareholders are buying, composite collections of shares and they don't even realize what corporations they have or what those corporations are doing. They have no knowledge of it. It's very hard to get them engaged. But that is an area of activism that already goes on, and informing shareholders and trying to organize shareholders to revolt. I think it is an effective idea.
Jerry, I have one last question for you. I believe that what we have today is an anti-democratic form of capitalism, and that as a result, those who are powerful enough, including the heads of corporation, hedge funds, equity partnerships, major financial players, are able to purchase politicians through their action committees or PAC groups, which in turn allows them to have rules and laws made on their behalf, like ALEC working at the state level, and major lobbyists, over 45,000 lobbyists who are registered, but probably double that amount of consultants that don't have to register in Washington. So behind the scenes are the people who control all the rules and laws, engagement in the media, and enforcement. So as a result, they can't do anything but get wealthier. So then how is our current capitalist system anything but undemocratic?
You said, you know, one of the sections of the book is called Privatization of Democracy. And right now, in the United States, we have the greatest example of that in probably all of history. We have a very small number of extreme wealthy people who are buying up Congress and buying up state legislators and buying up even the administration to a large extent. There's no other explanation for Obama not being tougher on climate change than it's all about who's invested in his campaigns, and that applies to quite a few other issues that are dominant now. These corporations get involved in the campaign expenditures. They get involved in media expenditures. They dominate consciousness, and they dominate politics, and that is ultra anti-democratic. But it's also an inevitable outcome of the capitalist drive toward constant expansion of wealth and to dominate resources, to dominate media, to dominate consciousness. All of that is built into the system. So there really needs to be an assessment of the system. This is why I write the book. You know, we need to start talking about this. We need to fight these battles systemically. And try to figure out how to design economics which are more localized, and where local control is possible, and where some control is possible. And the book goes into some of the work that's going on. There are thousands of researchers and activists now doing very, very good work on what an alternative system would look like. It has nothing to do with communism or show socialism. There are lots of ways of talking about economics that don't lead you down those paths.
Well, I agree. Jerry, we're out of time, and of course, at the heart of everything is this earth only has finite resources, yet capitalism and major corporations are acting at growth rates that would require 2 to 3 earths to keep them fulfilled in their manifest economic destiny. mandate. Thank you very much for an outstanding book, Gerrymander. We look forward to another discussion with you.
I look forward to it as well.
I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Now let's say hello to Utrece Lead. Hi, Utrece.
Hello, Gary. How are you?
Doing great.
We are taking a look at what came out of Hillary Clinton's appearance in Congress yesterday before the Senate and House committees.
Well, that should be interesting.
Yeah, it was. It was interesting. Yeah.
Put her up against a sumo wrestler. I'll bet on her. Utrece Lead right now on Progressive Radio Network.
Chances are, 'cause I wear a silly grin the moment you come.